Yeah, hi, Mia. My name is Jay Stancil. I'm an assistant federal public defender in Seattle, Washington. Well, as a federal public defender, we represent indigent people in federal court, and typically criminal defendants. But there's another category of case that we get involved in when people are have filed what's called a writ of habeas corpus, a petition for a writ of habeas corpus, which is claims unlawful or unconstitutional imprisonment. And in 1999, actually probably the winter, even the December before 1999, we got word that there were a number of people, actually several thousand across the country, that were being locked up by the Immigration Service when people who'd been ordered deported, but they had not been returned to their home countries because their countries refused to take them. And I had been talking to a reporter about a line of cases, one of which arose out of Sacramento, and because I'd had expertise in immigration law, I was consulting on the Sacramento case, and I just commented to my reporter friend that it would be interesting if we'd had cases like that in Seattle, and her response was, well, you do. You have 200 of these fellows that are locked up in the detention facility that I would visit every week. And what turned out is that they were on a floor with no access to free phones to the federal public defender or anybody else for that matter. And there are just approximately 200 guys that were simply lost and shoved away and warehoused, you know, potentially for their lifetimes. And so I asked her for some names, and I visited the facility and brought one fellow down whose name is Denis Batyuchenko, who came from the Soviet Union when it was the Soviet Union, and since then had the Soviet Union dissolved, and he is basically a man without a state because he's not a citizen of any country now. And Denis, like everybody else up there, felt like he was just locked up for goodness knows how long. And I asked Denis if he would like me to be his attorney to try to get him out and try to obtain his freedom. And he just lit up like a Christmas tree and said, of course, and took about 24 pro se petitions up into the jail, you know, so that people could fill these petitions for writs of habeas corpus out on their own and ask that we be their lawyers. And so within a couple of months, our office had been appointed to about 160 cases. Kim Ho Ma was one of those cases, and ultimately he was one of five individuals representing a cross-section of the 160 that was chosen by the district court here in Seattle to be representative of the whole group. And we combined those cases together and combined legal briefing on it and legal argument in order to litigate all 160 cases here in Seattle. So I met Kim shortly after this process began. He was housed in a local jail, and he had a scheduled interview with the Immigration Service, who had at that time a process that they were claiming was sufficient to guarantee that people were released when appropriate. All of these fellows, like Kim, had committed crimes and had served their jail sentences, but they were being held after they'd seen the immigration judge and after the immigration judge had ordered them deported, potentially forever, because the Immigration Service was stepping in and saying, we still don't think he's appropriate for release to the community. So I met Kim sight unseen one day and at the jail to get him prepared for that interview. And he struck me immediately as a person who's very smart, a young man who is very smart, Also, you know, really angry at the injustice that was happening to him and all the people around him. And so that was back in 1999. Ultimately, the government, we won the group of five cases with a unanimous five-judge opinion here in Seattle. And the Department of Justice, I think, focused on the Seattle case along with several others. But the Seattle case in particular, because it was being at that point then cited across the country as legal authority to obtain the freedom of other people. So the government immediately filed appeals on our cases in Seattle and then abandoned appeals for all but Kim Ho Ma of that first group of five. I think they believed Kim was somehow their best case, and I always believed he was my best case too. So over the course of the years then, they chose to focus and treat Kim Ho Ma as the lead case. And as when we won, my colleague and I won at the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, then they filed for a writ of certiorari or writ of review before the U.S. Supreme Court. That was ultimately heard in 2001. Well, the history of our argument was that it dates back to the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution, which says you can't be deprived of liberty without due process of law. And over time, that's been interpreted to prevent essentially what they're doing with Kim Ho Ma and all these other folks, which was preventative to detention, that none of these individuals had been charged with a new crime. Most of them had committed a crime but had served the full prison sentence for that crime. And so they were all essentially in INS detention for no other reason than the INS and by definition, the executive or the president and his delegates believe that these people were too dangerous to be let out. It has real, at least for a layperson, real analogs to the Japanese internment. In my mind, the legal theory is somewhat different. But in any case, it was the executive of the country saying, trust us, we can't release these people. They're too dangerous to be released. And at the same time, refusing to charge them with any crime and not having the statutory authority to do it. And a lot of the legal theories went back to the late 1800s, where some of the first constitutional cases in the immigration context dealt with Chinese immigrants and the Chinese exclusion and deportation laws of the 1880s. So ultimately, what the government's position boiled down to is that their legal theory rested on an interpretation of the Fifth Amendment that was harsher and more draconian than at any point in history. And because the case precedents that we relied upon went back to a case called Wong Wing, which was from 1893, I think. It went back to a Cold War case called Meze, where the government conceded in Meze, for instance, at the height of the Cold War, that they could, for a stateless person, a person that they could not return to a Iron Curtain country, that because he was at the border seeking entry into the United States, he would be locked up. But had he entered the country, had he accomplished a formal entry into the country, that he would certainly be allowed to be free. Whereas we found ourselves in 1999 at the close of the century dealing with some 4,000, mostly young men, who had not only entered the country, but they'd entered the country, you know, 15, 20, 25 years earlier. And the government was saying, no, we want more authority to lock people up than we had at the height of the Cold War. It was constitutionally, in my mind, a preposterous position to take, but it was the position that was taken by both the Clinton administration and then the Bush administration in our litigation. So primarily our clients were from the former Soviet Union, Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. And ultimately we won our case at the Supreme Court, not on the constitutional basis, but on the basis that the statute should be interpreted in a way that avoids what otherwise would have been a very dramatic constitutional showdown on the meaning of the Fifth Amendment in this context. And so in June of 2001, along with a case that was joined with Kim Homaz called Zadvydas, we prevailed at the Supreme Court, and the law that had arisen around Kim Ho's situation became the law of the country. Yeah, Jennifer Wellman and I were the two lawyers for Kim Ho Ma all the way up to this through the Supreme Court. It's Kim Ho Ma versus Ashcroft, or by that time, since we had prevailed, it was Ashcroft versus Kim Ho Ma. Yes, you know, technically, from a lawyer's standpoint, the Supreme Court dodged the constitutional issue by interpreting the statute in a way that avoided making a definitive ruling on the Constitution. Though much of the decision, the content of the decision, talks about and reaffirms what I think is our view of the reach and the breadth of the due process clause of the Fifth Amendment. So it was significant in that the government had never asked for this much power over non-citizens before these cases, and they failed to get it. And I'm real proud of my office's commitment to the litigation and our work on the case. Though all over the country, there were people in other federal defender offices and other private attorneys who were working on, you know, many hundreds of cases as well. Well, Kim Ho's crime was he, like many of his other friends, came to this country and were introduced into urban American poverty and came into adolescence at a time that also coincided with the rise of a lot of gang activity, certainly in the Western United States, I think all over. So, Kim was convicted of a gang-related shooting. The formal charge was that he was convicted of was manslaughter, first-degree manslaughter. And he served, I think he was given a 33-month sentence, and he served two-thirds of that. So he actually spent about 2 years in jail and prison. Then he spent another 2.5 years in immigration, prison, essentially, not having any new charge whatsoever. So his unlawful INS detention eclipsed the amount of time that he did for the crime itself. But, I can comment in general about what's happened with a lot of these young men without being real specific to, you know, Kim Ho's parents who are, you know, still in Seattle, for instance, that for many of these, particularly Southeast Asian kids, they came as refugees from, in the case of Cambodia, horrific circumstances of the genocide of the Khmer Rouge. The families and the adults that escaped the Khmer Rouge, that brought their children to this country, had a very, very high percentage of issues with dealing with mental illness, such as post-traumatic stress disorder. Highly distressed refugee population that then became extremely isolated and insulated from the rest of America, and having very few tools with which to deal with raising children, particularly adolescents, in urban hardcore poverty. So it was a very typical cycle to see amongst a lot of these families, including Kim Ho. Parents who didn't have a clue what was going on when their children would come home with gang colors on and so forth. At the same time, the children are a minority within minority populations, and physically smaller in stature, and many of them from an early age bonded together both for the camaraderie and friendship, but also for security, because a lot of them are growing up in very rough neighborhoods. And so kids got in trouble, and parents increasingly had a difficult time trying to understand the trouble that they were in and trying to understand the very real jeopardy that their kids were in, because all of these kids were not only in jeopardy of going to prison, but they were in jeopardy of being returned to these countries that their parents had fled. And that was just such a common misapprehension that because of cultural isolation and lack of learning the English, the elders of these groups rarely had the wherewithal or the resources or the education or the psychic energy to apply for citizenship, and they certainly didn't know how important it was to apply for citizenship. And so without being citizens, they continued to try to heal their very broken lives by raising a family here without understanding that if their kids would get in trouble, not only would they get in trouble and go to jail or prison, but they could get deported for the rest of their lives. Or in the case early on for the Cambodians, they could get locked up in the U.S. government's point of view forever, for life. I mean, the Immigration Service used to call these guys lifers before that term became publicly known. They would call these guys lifers because they would come into detention and they would laugh and say, the kids would say, I got ordered deported, now what happens? And they'd say, well, you're here for life. We'll lock you up for life. So you have this unsophisticated, largely uneducated, certainly not English-speaking group of elders that experienced just intolerable cruelty and hardship and terror at the hands of the Khmer Rouge. And then they flee due to the good graces in their eyes of the United States. And here they are, totally not understanding what is going on when they live in the land of freedom and their kids are not only getting locked up for doing a wrong thing and serving the time for doing a wrong thing, but they are now being locked up forever. I'm very happy to say that we were successful at our litigation, where we, won the freedom of people in Seattle, and due to our cases, some thousands of people were released across the country. But what happened with the Cambodians then, though, is the same thing that could happen, next year or 5 years from now for the Vietnamese or the Laotian. The state of Cambodia started accepting people back in 2002. So not surprisingly, Kim Ho Ma, whose case went to the Supreme Court, was pretty close to the top of the list of the U.S. government's hopes for requests for travel documents to Cambodia. And so in October of 2002, Kim was deported. So now this cycle of this refugee cycle of people who have fled and through some miracle pull their children out of the jungles of Cambodia, out of the hands of the Khmer Rouge, and somehow manage to get into this new world in the United States are being re-traumatized all over again by having their children ripped out of their own arms and sent back to Cambodia, a place where for many elders in this community, they still firmly believe that people are subject to torture or death immediately upon exiting the airplane. So it's been a very troubling and sad thing to watch families being broken up when they have experienced all too much trauma in their lifetimes, more trauma than anybody should have to experience. Well, he has. I mean, over many of our fellows, we call them the old timers, the folks that were released back in 99 through our litigation, they all mostly just got back to their lives again and got back to their wives or their mothers and fathers and got jobs and just were back in their community. And most of them would just as soon forget what they had gone through. But Kim Ho was unable to do that because the government kept focusing on his case. They wanted to overturn his case. Excuse me. They wanted to overturn his case in order to overturn everybody else's case. And so Kim was never able to walk away from the burden of potentially being incarcerated all over again if, you know, the lawyers failed. And if the legal theory and legal arguments failed. But this at the same time was not something that he could talk to his parents, just like when he was in school, he couldn't talk to his parents about the pressures he was seeing at school that led him to do whatever he did back then. So Kim started hanging out more and more with my family and my sons, Toby and Adam. My wife, Dory, became a informal surrogate mother to him and counselor, and Kim would routinely drop by with baskets of food from the local Cambodian market and just to be with somebody who understood what he was facing, what the risks were, and what his life was. So, you know, he became like a son to us, a brother to us, and a big brother to my children. So though I've worked with immigrants since 1988, this was the first time that I really felt like I experienced a family member being deported. Especially when they started taking people back and there was a great deal of fear by his family that Kim Ho would be amongst the next groups. We became increasingly close to his mother and his father and his siblings as well. So there's been this, it's very tragic that he had to be deported and very tragic that his mother, who literally carried him out of the jungles of Cambodia walking 2 days straight without sleep, with him wrapped in a scarf around her neck, that she has to lose this miracle child that somehow survived that trek to the refugee camp. From my point of view, and I know for the rest of my family, it's been the silver lining has been this very rich experience of being brought into this whole community of people and being feeling like family to a whole nation and a whole group of people here in Seattle, and particularly Kim Ho's family. So yes, we are going. I'm taking a leave of absence, and we'll be in Cambodia for 6 months, beginning in a couple weeks now. You know, that's a good question. I, roughly speaking, I think we've had maybe a total of 70 Cambodian American clients who were put in immigration detention and whose freedom we worked for. There have been maybe 10 of those folks who have been deported. That's just my rough guess. There's probably a total of 1,400 or 1,500 Cambodian American, mostly men, waiting to get deported right now. You know, I should know this. I think it's approximately 110, 112 that have been deported thus far, beginning in June of 2002. There's another group that I've heard is gathering that will be deported in early December. Well, it works in two different ways. In one way of looking at it, it works in two different ways. If you are from a country that accepts people back, you're ordered deported and you're gone. And that's a extremely sad and tragic event for many families, and it's been that way for over 100 years. What still happens with the people who are not readily deportable, whereas, if you're a Laotian or a Vietnamese, there's no repatriation agreement at all. So, those folks, if they commit a crime that makes them deportable, they'll serve their time. They'll go into immigration detention. They'll be ordered deported, and then because of the litigation that we won, they will be released. Sooner or later, it may take a couple months. You're right, to go back to the community and to essentially be on an order of supervision by the immigration authorities here in the United States, only to be deported maybe 5 or 10 years from now when an agreement is signed. You know, Cuba is another country where there's a huge number of Cubans out there that are also dealing with this issue. For Cambodians, because it's still, the removals to Cambodia are still at a very slow pace. By and large, we've been successful at getting those individuals out and back to their families as well. Though some of them, for instance, like one client who has children and a U.S. citizen children, U.S. citizen wife, was only able to go home for about 3 months before he was removed to Cambodia. I should also mention that one of the things, and I guess by the time this airs, we'll know the answer to this, but there currently is a case up at the Supreme Court that is testing the scope and how broadly the decision in Zadvydas and Kim Ho Ma governs particular ramifications for Cuban Americans who are here, who are, in a legal sense, people that at the border seeking entry when they have been taken into immigration custody. There's two active Cuban cases that should be decided here any week now by the Supreme Court. Well, I think there are many layers of tragedy that are largely ignored by the policymakers in this country, and one of them is that the experiences that these families went through are unimaginable for, I'd say, the vast majority of congressional representatives. I don't think anybody should revisit trauma to any of these families ever. I don't think any child whose family escapes any country, whether it's Somalia or Iraq or Cambodia, who then grows up and is largely, well, is totally Americanized and is not, doesn't hold any, or holds little, if any, connection to their home country. I don't think any of those refugee children should ever be deported. I think if they do harm, they should do, they should be convicted of a crime and serve a sentence and be allowed to return to their family. So what many of us are advocating for with the Cambodian experience as the most illustrative example is to just simply have a rule that once you enter as a refugee, you are granted permanent safe haven from the countries that you fled. And there's another aspect of this, too. I think it's a tragedy for any refugee to be deported to the country that they fled. But one might argue, and people do argue, that, well, if they do harm or if they do a bad thing in this country, they should pay for it, and they're here as a generous gesture of the United States. But the truly innocent people involved in this are the mothers and the wives and the children of the men that are getting deported and the refugees that are getting deported, and nobody can look Kim Ho Ma's mother in the eye and tell her she should suffer again after having saved her family through unimaginable odds, that she should suffer again by having her miracle child taken away from her forever. And I don't think people are thinking about that. I don't think they were thinking about that when they created when they dramatically expanded the reach of the criminal immigration laws in 1996, that in a way that largely ruled out any defense to deportation for anybody, let alone refugees. And while the immigration law, I think, needs to be reformed on a whole host of levels, I think one of the most immediate places to reform is to prevent the re-traumatizing by official U.S. sanctions deportation of families that have been experienced all too much trauma already in their lives. Well, in 1996, there are two different sets of changes to the Immigration Act that dramatically changed the landscape of immigration law. Prior to 96, if nearly anyone committing a crime would be able to speak to the immigration judge, explain his or her circumstances, demonstrate, you know, how hard it would be or how wrong it would be or how traumatic it would be for his deportation to take place and obtain a waiver of deportation. And this only makes sense because for every hard and fast rule one can say about deportation, one can also point to an individual who is deserving of an exception to that rule. And so the 1996 law largely eliminated waivers of deportation by greatly expanding the definition for what's called an aggravated felony, to the point that people who had been convicted of misdemeanor assaults and given no jail time but 1 year suspended sentence were considered aggravated felons and thereafter ordered deported with no defense. So while the law had been harsh all along and while the system had been enormously flawed in many places in the country by, questionable work by immigration judges, by, poor enforcement tactics and unconstitutional practices by the INS. It was a system that still seemed to allow for a second chance for people who deserved it. And 1996, it wiped it out. It wiped it out for not only Cambodians, but for Mexicans, for everybody. And I think it was a heartless, wrong-headed thing to do. And cost enormous amounts of money to engage in this enforcement practice that is that always comes after any individual has served a jail or prison sentence. So the and for the Cambodians and for the and other individuals who weren't getting deported, this was a hidden this was a hidden tragedy for many years. Because if your kids aren't getting deported, the community really doesn't understand the extent of the problem. And so for the Latino communities where kids were getting deported, young men were getting deported, they had an understanding of how harsh the law had become. For the Cambodian, Vietnamese, and Laotian communities, I think there is a real element of shame for a lot of these families. And so I think a lot of the community just didn't understand that this was an issue, that this was a problem. Children were getting ordered deported, young adults were getting ordered deported, but families weren't talking about it amongst their communities, and they didn't have to deal with it because kids weren't getting deported at that point in time. But it's taken on a different flavor now, and there are many immigrant advocates and Cambodian Americans across the country that are advocating for a change in the law, and they're trying to reach out and gather allies such as the Vietnamese American and Laotian American communities. So, 96 was a start of a what's turned into a flood of deportations to all countries all over the world. And people have been fighting ever since to try to roll it back and insert some justice back into the Immigration Act. Well, I think, unfortunately, there's a sad history going back to the 1880s of heartlessly deporting people out of this country who have very intense and clear and heartfelt connections to this country. I think for every tragic Cambodian story we could come up with, there are tragic stories from the 1880s of families that are ripped apart because of the totally racist immigration laws at that time. The immigration changes in the 1880s was largely aimed at one particular population, the Chinese, and fueled by explicit statements, racist statements about that the Chinese immigrants are raping white women, and they're all drug addicts, and they're taking our jobs. Many of these claims back then have a lot of resonance to the claims of the right wing today, and yet the reality on the ground at that time as now is that, families are being ripped apart, and there's no purpose to doing that when we all live on the same planet. So, and this is the hardest thing to get a lot of the Cambodian American community to understand, because so for years they looked to the U.S. government as their savior, and now the U.S. government acts as the oppressor to their community, and what they don't understand is this has been going on for a very, very long time, and it's been one of the traditional, though totally inappropriate, safety valves for popular discontent about the economy and various other things, that just to blame it on a group of immigrants, whether it's the Chinese or at times the Italians or at times the Irish, everybody's, you know, fallen under the racist aims of conservative, xenophobic, and racist activists and politicians in the United States. It's been going on for a long time, but it doesn't mean it has to keep going. I think it's what makes this country great is its diversity, and that's what makes us strong. And I think it's a it's in my mind, the immigration laws and how they've kept getting worse and worse and worse decade after decade is really a blasphemy to what we are all about in this country and concepts of basic fairness and democratic thinking. Yes, yeah, I realize I gave you a very long answer, but yeah, I do think it's a continuation of what has been decades upon decades of you know, extremely wrong-headed and at the heart racist public policy, and many people said that, you know, for instance, the Cambodian deportations, did this come about because of 9/11? Because the deportations did follow that tragedy on the East Coast, where our own country fell under attack. And, you know, I don't think so. And I don't think that September 11th means we have to think differently about immigrants and refugees. I think one of the saddest one of the saddest things that we've come to following 9/11 is this sense of pervasive fear of people on the outside trying to hurt us, and how that has been used by the right wing to ratchet up and the draconian laws that are already so draconian, and to limit civil rights and human rights in this country, and to further wreak damage in the immigrant and refugee communities all over the country. I think that's a horrible trend, and I think it has the potential of being, you know, a trend that'll go on for decades, because we're the war on terrorism is a war against an unseen enemy that can never be proven to be vanquished. And as a consequence, if people are willing to buy into racial profiling and no-fly lists for airplanes and harsher and harsher border security issues, and, you know, let's build a wall. You know, you could build a wall, you know, 10 miles high around this country, and we're still not going to be safe. But currently, it's the popular thinking of quite a bit of the American public, I'm afraid, and the ultimate victims are people who, relatively speaking, are absolutely harmless. The post 9/11 immigration related initiatives and prosecutions and so forth, there'd be huge sweeps of airport under the auspices of protecting our borders and protecting us for terrorism, and the only people that were getting rounded up were undocumented workers doing what they've been doing for hundreds of years, just trying to make a living in a place that will pay them to feed their families and to feed their babies. So, I think there is a ominous trend that, though this has been a very sorry and tragic history dating back to the 1880s, I think the power that the federal government has been seeking over the last number of years, is particularly since 1996 and even more so since 9/11, is unprecedented in the history of our country. And if that power is consolidated against immigrants and refugees, I think we'll all suffer greatly. Yeah, there have been many of us, many Cambodian Americans and many immigrant advocates who have been working to change the immigration law to accommodate a number of problems with it. Ideally, I think the laws of 1996 should just simply be rolled back and the law be put back in the place where it was prior to that time and allow people the opportunity to seek a second chance if they've made a mistake. Short of that, and I think, unfortunately, I think we have to think more pragmatically, it makes sense to at least look at the circumstances of refugee families who have fled persecution from their home countries, and as well as asylum, people who've been granted asylum, which essentially means that they've met the definition for refugees. I think if we could acknowledge that the Cambodian situation is representative of what many, many communities are facing, like the Somalis, for instance, or the Sudanese, and you know, just name your place of horrific conflict that's beyond the imaginations of most Americans. I think looking at these groups would be a good place to start, and acknowledging that these families have experienced enough hardship, they do not need to be ripped apart. There are a number of us who are working together to try to develop strategies for creating statutory changes and also administrative approaches to these communities. Actually, a couple ways of looking at this, but as I have gone through this, and as a lawyer, I mean, for 5 years, I represented people in deportation proceedings, and sometimes we would lose, and it'd be really sad, and I'd see my clients get deported. But it wasn't until now that I had an inkling of what family members really feel when it happens, and it does. And I saw my own children crying themselves to sleep because their brother was getting deported, that Kim Ho was gone. And then once you understand that, once you feel that, you start realizing how morally bankrupt it is for us to draw borders around ourselves and say you can't cross from here, from there to here, and how it defies logic. We're more and more in a world that is emphasizing the international flow of commerce and capital. I think it's nonsense to imagine that people don't have the right on this planet to go where they want to go. And you can still protect this country from terrorism by, searching for and rooting out terrorists. But it makes no one safe to deport a 21-year-old Mexican kid that's been here since he was 2 years old. It makes no one safer to deport Kim Ho Ma, who left Cambodia when he was 2 years old. Borders are a preposterous thing, and it's an evil that I think abstractly is one of the most important things for us to work to overcome. So I had this conversation with a friend that I got to know who is a deportation officer with the immigration authorities here. And he's from another country, and his brother still lives there. And I asked him how things were going in the post 9/11 era, and he just shook his head and said his brother was just trying his darndest just to come visit. And he couldn't. You know, here's a fellow who's working for the Immigration Service in the United States, and his own brother can't come to visit, can't get on an airplane and fly to the other side of the planet and land and just see his nieces and nephews and his brother. And I think it's astoundingly wrongheaded to think that whether it's 130 years of traditional repression of non-citizens that we can't turn back the clock and do it right now. So I'm always wishing for peace in a world without borders now. Okay, thank you. Okay, thanks, Maya. Bye.
Okay, so we are done.
Okay. Bye-bye. Oh. Yeah, I tried to behave myself, but my hands are active, though. Okay, I could do that. Okay, so ready? I don't think anybody should revisit trauma to any of these families ever. Or can I do it another way? I don't think anybody should reintroduce trauma to any of these families ever. Kim would routinely drop by with exotic foods from a Cambodian market just to be with somebody. How'd that sound? Okay. They all mostly got back to their lives again and got back to their wives. They all mostly got back to their lives again and got back to their wives. Parents who didn't have a clue when their kids would come home with gang colors on and so forth. Okay, thank you. You're right. Yeah. Parents who didn't have a clue what was going on when their kids came home with gang colors.